The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Brad McDonald, author of The Art and Skill of Sales Psychology, Why Buyers and Sellers Do What They Do, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you are a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. This show is produced by my marketing firm. We work with manufacturers to help them grow. If you're a manufacturer and are serious about growing your business, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers and you'll find the guide at the top of the organic results. And special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is a really cool app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, and if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast or just click on the link at Marketing Book Podcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Brad McDonald to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Art and Skill of Sales Psychology, Why Buyers and Sellers Do What They Do. Brad McDonald is an operations director at Sandler Training, the largest global provider of sales and management training in the world, with over 250 operating units in more than 32 countries. He is responsible for domestic franchisee support and growth. And prior to working for Sandler, Brad was a Sandler franchise owner. And interesting fact, he is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and spent 28 years in the U.S. Navy, principally as a submarine officer and ultimately a submarine commander. Brad, congratulations on the art and skill of sales psychology, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much, Douglas. I am very happy to be your guest today.
Well, I should say also that you are only the second Naval Academy graduate on the show, but both of you were submarine commanders who wrote books about sales. So I'm talking about John Asher, who wrote Close Deals Faster. So I really seem to be burrowing into this niche of Naval Academy grads who were submarine commanders who've written books about sales.
I think it's a small niche, Douglas. You might have reached the end of the pipeline. I think of all the tens of thousands of Naval Academy graduates and then the thousands that became submarine officers, probably you hit all of them that eventually became sales trainers.
Okay, but you know, it's life goals are important. If there's another one out there that was a submarine officer who has written a book about sales, I'm getting him on this show. Okay, there, I said it.
We're going to send him your way.
Yeah, thank you. So, after over 230 interviews on the Marketing Book Podcast, this is the first interview I've done with someone who is a very close friend. Although you, of course, won't admit that, but for the sake of the listener, I should explain our background together. So, gosh, over 15 years ago, after I'd started my business, I was banging my head against the wall, which I'm perfectly capable and comfortable doing, but it was as it related to sales, and I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. So next thing I knew, I found this guy named Brad McDonald in town here in Norfolk, Virginia, and signed up for his sales training, and then ultimately... if you do it long enough, you just stop paying. And then you later went on to work for Sandler. You sold your franchise to Chad Stencil. And one of the deals of selling that is that he had to accept whatever commitments you already had, which means that Douglas Burdett continues to show up once a week, drink his coffee, and he still hasn't made a dime off of me. But at any rate, over the years, we've become pretty good friends. You remind me a lot of my older brother. You treat me like a younger brother, which is to say abusively. And which, you know, when my older brothers would beat me up, they'd always say, hey, stop crying. We wouldn't do this if we didn't like you. So along the way, I've gotten to meet your family, and you've taken me to Naval Academy football games, which I later found out you did because your wife didn't want to go. But I'm happy to step into that role. So now everybody knows what the deal is here. I don't know if there's anything you need to add about that, or if you're just going to deny everything I just said.
No, I concur with everything you said, and I'll admit it's been a very nice relationship for 15 years. And I do want to say on your behalf that even though the current Sandler office in Norfolk, you're right, doesn't make money off of you, I think that you bring a lot of personality and maybe some intelligence and good looks to the class, too.
Oh, so, stop it.
Mostly good insights. And the same kind of wit that you use on this show. So I think you're always welcome. Probably at any Sandler office, anywhere in the country, you could stop in.
Well, you know what? And we were going to talk about this later, but I recall when Dave Mattson was on the podcast to talk about the book Sandler Enterprise Selling. He's the president and CEO of Sandler. And we also had Marcus Kauke from the UK talk about his book, Making Channel Sales Work. And they both talked about how anyone who's listening to this can go call their local Sandler trainer and sit in on one class. You just have to go to, I think it's Sandler.com, and you can find out. Just go visit them. You don't have to buy from them. Just go check it out.
That is true. For the most part, most Sandler owners, although they are independent businesses, and it's their right to do what they want with our class, but most of them would welcome a call from any of your listeners, especially, and come in and sample the training or ask a few questions.
Yeah. So you were a submarine officer, Naval Academy grad. Your dad, Naval Academy, class of 49, he was a submarine officer. One of your sons graduated from the Naval Academy and went into that same line of work. I had no idea it was like a family business.
Maybe organic, how it all happened. It wasn't really planned right. That way by my father when he enlisted in the Navy in World War II, and then at the end of the war found himself on a train to the Naval Academy, a place he really hadn't heard of. Didn't know much about. And so it just kind of happened for him. And yet we sort of ended up keeping up the family tradition. We're also, I would like to think we're a diverse family because I have a brother-in-law who was a Navy pilot. I have a nephew who's also a Naval Academy graduate who's a surface warfare officer.
Oh, yes.
And his sister, my niece, is married to a United States Marine Corps officer, is a pilot of a
sea. Yeah, so she's
pretty diverse.
Yeah, so she had the Naval Academy background, and then she married a Marine. So I guess, would you call that a mixed marriage?
No, he's actually a graduate of the Naval Academy.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. Uh-oh.
All in the family.
Now I'm going to get my butt kicked by every Marine I know in town here, so as it should be. But your book is dedicated to your late father, and I was so happy to have met him a few times. And in the book, you talked about how you said that he always believed that you could move the world with your fingertips, with your writing. And you wrote, "I'm not that good, but he thought I was." And I've just got to say that even the few times I got to meet him, I thought, you know, I think that guy's kind of proud of me.
liked you too. That's right.
I know. He's interested in what I'm up to. And he was just such a fantastic listener. So when I read that at the beginning, I just thought, boy, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It ties into the main concept or theme of my book, which is don't try to get your emotional needs met in your sales calls or your business. And I was the winner of the daddy lottery.
Yes.
I had this father who, up until I was 62 years old, if we're allowed to admit our age on this. I know you're much younger. But until I was 62 years old, I had this wonderful father who I could call every day, and he would just tell me nice things and tell me everything was okay. So that was a good place to get emotional needs met.
Yeah, and even a tough guy like you who commanded, you know, a submarine, it was a submarine officer chasing the Soviets all around the world, even a tough guy like you needed to hear things like that. I think there's a message there for any kind of salesperson or business owner.
That really goes to why I started writing the things that became this book. And can I take a second to kind of tell that story?
Yes, and let's make sure to mention your mom.
Yeah. Well, my mother is what a wonderful lady, 89 years old. She's a high school graduate, Little Rock, Arkansas, in the 1940s, and no formal education beyond that. A great writer, a prolific reader, a very self-educated woman, and she proofread my articles. She's a great editor. But it was interesting. You talked about the submarine career, and I like to think in those days that I was a pretty tough guy and a brave man, not afraid to chase the Soviets, the Libyans, the Koreans, whoever was on the table at the time, not afraid to die for my country, and sometimes not even afraid of the biggest enemy of all out there, which was the ocean. And when I came into sales, got out of the Navy and came into commissioned sales and had to pick up the telephone to make my first cold call, I was terrified and my hands were shaking, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
Why am I so scared? Why is this so difficult?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. And it also brought to mind another book that was on the podcast by Jeb Blunt, where he talked about – he's done a lot of work with military recruiters of all things, along with all the companies he's worked with. And he talked in his book about objections about these military recruiters. In this case, these were U.S. Army combat veterans, infantrymen, you know, non-commissioned officers. And he found out that they were more afraid to pick up the phone and talk to high school teenagers, who were their prospects to get them to join the military, than they were of armed conflict.
I can believe it.
Yeah. So your book goes into a lot about that. Now, we're going to talk about that and a few other things. We're going to talk about the psychological games that buyers play. We're going to talk about the fears that your customers have and how you can help alleviate that, and how transactional analysis can help you in sales and your marriage, more importantly. And a little bit about how to, something of interest to the listeners, how to program your brain for success. What I want to do is start with one excerpt, and then we'll get going with some of these other more specific questions. In the introduction, you say, if you are in sales and have struggled to understand the mind of your prospect, if you wonder why honest, moral, ethical people think they can lie to a salesperson and still make it to heaven, if you want to better control that sales interaction that seems to ride a fine line between trust and confusion, or if you struggle to understand your own mindset and frustrations when selling, perhaps this book will speak to you and provide an insight or two that will help you in controlling your sales calls. To sales managers and coaches, let me suggest that the best way to help your struggling salesperson may be to help them create a better understanding of people's fears, anxieties, and confusion about the sales process, both the sellers and the buyers. If you're willing to consider that possibility, please think of this book as a primer for exploring why people do what they do in sales situations. Understanding this is more essential than drilling your team in the right tactics. Of course, the tactics are important. They're the answer to the question, what do I do? But understanding the why behind the what might be the best place to start. So, Brad, towards the end of the book, you state that astute salespeople understand that in many respects, they are unlicensed psychologists who just happen to be selling a product or service instead of seeing patients. Explain.
Well, I think that comes from the Sandler saying that is sales is a Broadway play put on by a psychologist. And as we mentioned, coming out of the Navy, for me, two more different worlds probably had never collided. The world in the Navy, where generally on a submarine, I felt like if I treated my sailors with respect, if I told them the truth, and I kept them informed about what was going on, well, in return, they treated me with respect, they followed my orders, and they told me the truth. And I came out of the Navy and I came into sales, and I found that prospects didn't always tell the truth. They didn't have this compelling need to respect me in terms of honoring agreements and appointments and things. And they certainly felt no compelling need to follow my orders. So I was perplexed by that. To say perplexed is an understatement. I was overwhelmed by it. I was dismayed by it. And I spent more than one or two times hanging my head after being stiffed by a prospect who didn't honor their agreements. So I started to explore this idea of, you know, why do people treat me that way? Why do they do that? Why do they do those things to me? And then I happened upon Sandler and started learning some of these concepts. And back to that saying, sales is a Broadway play put on by a psychiatrist. And I think what David Sandler meant when he said that was, he said, there's a little bit of acting, not deceptive acting. And at no point do I ever encourage a salesperson to be disingenuous or untruthful or lie. But sometimes we have to act a little bit, meaning on the outside, we want that salesperson to be nurturing, caring, passionate, involved. But on the inside, they need to be kind of like a brain surgeon. That's why we say in Sandler, which maybe we'll touch on later, 30% of your sales comes from your adult ego state. That's the computer inside that's saying, what do I do next? What do I do now? And 70% is your nurturing parent, which on the external means I'm kind, caring, nurturing. So maybe a little bit off track there, but that's what that Broadway play put on by a psychiatrist means. And I think the things that salespeople go through that, for especially in the first few years, getting used to the idea that prospects don't feel a need to be honest, keep agreements, things like that. It bears to this psychological aspect of what are buyers thinking on the inside. And a good salesperson will get to where they can read people and ask the right questions to get to the truth. Because that's the ultimate challenge in sales. What is the truth here?
Yes, it was interesting in the book where you were able to explain about how, you know, you'd been a submarine commander. That's the stuff, you know, that's like right up there with rock stars and firemen. No. Well, in terms of things that people, you know, want to aspire to. And you talked about how when you would say jump, somebody would on the way up would ask how high. And then
that's right.
You went through this wrenching change. And it really, you know, messed with your head, as I think it would with most anyone. And in the book, you talk about how it ultimately led you to study more about transactional analysis. And that became the milestone at which you really started to understand more about sales and became more successful. So let's jump into that. I just want to read one other quote from the book, and then I want to talk about this transactional analysis concept, which is really, for me, was the backbone of the book. And there's a lot of other things we're going to talk about, but let me quote from it, page 56, where you say, transactional analysis, TA, defines three ego states that influence our behavior: the parent, the adult, and the child. The parent ego stores information about what is right or wrong, good or bad, acceptable or unacceptable. The adult ego state is the logical, rational part of your makeup. It weighs the pros and cons of a situation without the emotional involvement. The child is the emotional part of your makeup. This is where feelings and emotions are stored, feelings and emotions that influence you your entire life, whether you are buying, selling, or doing something else entirely. The child is where most decisions originate. The child is the little six-year-old within who, when feeling a particular emotion, says, I want that. So if you could explain more, use that as a jumping off point to explain, and I can remember over the years seeing you put PAC on the board in two columns,
yeah.
And explain about the parent, the child, the adult, and the interaction of all of them, perhaps why you don't want the seller doesn't want their child there, and how the goal is to have it as much adult to adult as possible.
The child ego state is, as you said, and as you read from the book, is what I believe is where decisions originate, meaning it's the emotional part. people believe that they make decisions intellectually. People believe they need facts and figures and information to make decisions. I believe, and I think this is backed up by a lot of psychologists and a lot of researchers and a lot of books, that the actual decision to buy something, like I really want that, that comes from an emotional core, an emotional part of your brain. And every decision we've ever made, to a great extent, was made on an emotional basis. After that decision was made, I want that, I need it, I got to have it. After we make that decision, then comes the intellectual part of our brain that steps in and justifies it. And that's where David Sandler's expression came from when he said, people make decisions emotionally, they justify them intellectually. So in the sales process, theoretically, we would say we want our prospect, when we're discussing their problem, their concern, what it is they need, we want them in somewhat of a child ego state, meaning the emotional part of them has to say, I want this, I need it. This is whatever my current situation is, it's causing me a problem, I don't like it, something has to change. Those kind of things come from the child ego state, the emotional part. Salespeople frequently, and this is what I did early on, is they jump to intellectual justifications. You know from your Sandler training, we call that feature and benefit selling, where I try to give people information about my product or service and think, because this information sounds good to me, it's going to sound good to them. The problem is, giving people information, facts, and figures usually does not get them emotionally involved. I think I quoted in the book somewhere Albert Einstein, one of my favorite historical figures, and he said,
imagination. Oh, are you asking me? Because to see if I paid attention in class, imagination is more important than intelligence.
Well, yeah, imagination is more important than knowledge, I think was the words. But
Why I need to keep going to class.
That's right. And I think what he meant was people think in terms of imagination. They don't think in terms of facts and figures. And if you ever picture yourself driving down the road with the radio not on and thinking, and you recall some of those thoughts, they're usually things that you're imagining. So the fact that people think in terms of imagination, not facts and figures, means how do we initially approach them in a sales process? Well, the more effective way would be to approach their imagination. Tell me about your current situation. What could be better about it? What would you like your current situation to look like? Imagine yourself 6 months from now with this problem solved. What does that look like? That's a good conversation to get somebody emotionally involved. Putting a brochure in front of them with facts, figures, and details and information usually appeals to the salesperson because they think this is cool stuff, but it doesn't appeal to the prospect. Real life story. You've heard my window story many times, and it's all true.
Well, you should share that story with the listeners.
Well, there's many chapters to the window story, but one chapter is that a window salesman comes over to our house. This was about 3 years ago, and we had had over the years many window people in to look at this one situation in the kitchen, three windows, two sliding glass doors. And each time I said to myself, I'm perfectly willing to spend $5,000 to get this whole thing fixed and get these replaced. But generally, the salespeople would say, well, let me look around the house and so on and so forth and start big presentations on why I should replace every window in the house. This one particular one that I'm thinking of, though, the guy comes in, he sits down at the kitchen table, and we start talking, and I tell him what I'm interested in. And I said flat out to this fine gentleman, please do not put a brochure in front of me. That will not work. It will turn me off. I told him flat out. I said, this is the problem that I'm having with these windows, and I want to know if you can replace these windows and these two doors. And he listened for a few minutes, and he talked, and he said, he opened up his briefcase, and he said, there's just a couple things that I have to show you. And he pulled out this fairly thick brochure. And I said, you don't have to show it to me. And he said, I really do. And he proceeded to show me the things in the brochure and give me some thermal ratings of windows and things like that. And I thought, this poor guy, he's so locked on to his presentation, he has to put this information in front of me. But of course, what he did was he put facts and figures and knowledge in front of me instead of stoking my imagination, which at that time, it was an issue about selling the house and getting some things fixed, instead of using my imagination and say, let's say we get these windows fixed and these doors, nice new doors. You think that's going to help improve the selling price of your house? that would have worked on my imagination. Mm-hmm. So,
and the child would have said, I want that. And if the child is not in the sales process, I don't see how you're going to get a sale.
Yeah, I think you're right. And so by putting information in front of people too early in the sales process, we eliminate that their child ego state from being involved. And when people say, in fact, something that I became aware of was when I would initially be prospecting, calling people up, and they would say, just send me a brochure. It took me a while to realize that was their subconscious effort to keep the process intellectual. Mm-hmm. Because once they say, send me a brochure, send me information, things like that, now we're back to an intellectual process and their child's not involved. So anyway, back to the issue. So if we say early in a sales call, we're going to ask questions and help people use their imagination, steer them in a direction of what's your current situation, what do you not like about it, what could your situation look like in the future, we're tapping into their child ego state. Once this child says, yes, I think I would like to have this improvement in my life, this better point B over my current point A. So they've sort of made an emotional decision. I want this. Now is the right time to use the adult ego state and the parent ego state to, as David Sandler said, intellectually justify the decision.
Okay. Now let's back up for a second and remind listeners what the parent ego state is and why that kind of gets sealed off at about what, age five?
Yeah, five, six, seven, somewhere in there. Basically, if I could take you when you were born and gently, carefully place next to your brain an old-fashioned cassette tape recorder and hit record and record for 5 or 6 or 7 years every message that came into your brain from outside sources, most of those messages came from where?
Oh, my parents.
That's your parents and other authority
figures. Well, and yes, and my older brothers, which we've right. talked about.
Yeah, in your case, you had.
Yeah, but there's therapists for these issues I have, but please go ahead.
Yeah. So in your case, almost everybody around you is an authority figure. You're 2 years old with all these authority figures. Mm-hmm. And so everything that comes in is what we call a parent type message. What do those things sound like? Sit down, shut up, eat everything on your plate, do this, do that, be good, be nice.
And don't talk about money. Don't talk yes. to strangers.
Right. So basically people were telling you what to do. And that's what we call kind of the controlling or critical parent.
Right. So, and one other was, Brad, my dad was a West Point graduate. So it was avoid people from the Naval Academy.
Right.
So you see, I've been able to break through some of those
good.
Tapes. Yeah, please go ahead.
That's good. So, but you also probably had a nice nurturing mother, and even your brothers, when they beat you up, they said, we only do this because we love you. Mm-hmm. And that was a nurturing.
They still mother. Say that.
They still say that. So you have these controlling messages and these nurturing messages. So we have this controlling parent, this nurturing parent. But anyway, about 6 or 7, that recorder goes to read only. It's difficult to rewrite the tape. So if you got a lot of nurturing when you were a young child, you might be a nurturing person now. And if you got a lot of sit down, shut up, be good, be nice, eat everything on your plate, you might tend to emulate that. Mm-hmm. In any case, we say in sales, if you are the salesperson, your nurturing parent is a very good thing to bring into your sales call. That's the genuine complimentary nurturing, kind person who's really caring about the prospect's problems. That's your
nurturing. Your dad comes to mind.
He was a nurturing guy. It's true.
Yeah.
He was very good at that. So if you have this, you know, on the other side of the table, or your prospect is somewhat in their child mode, thinking about how you might help them make their life better, and you're being nurturing, that's a good combination. Mm-hmm. On the inside, we want the adult going on. What is the adult? We said the parent was
let me back up. You don't want to be the critical parent talking to the prospect.
Oh, no, because that's the one that tells people what they should do and shouldn't
yeah.
do.
Yeah, and I've seen plenty of salespeople who are acting like critical parents, cross-examination, and it's like, no.
I know, yeah. And I'm sure I did plenty of that early in my sales career, too. So the critical parent, when the critical parent says, you should do this, you should do that. If I say, Douglas, you should sit down, you should eat everything on your plate, or you should spend more time respecting Naval Academy graduates, what is the natural reaction that you might have, whether you're too polite to say it or not? What's your kind of natural reaction?
Well, it's what I always say to you. You're not the boss of me.
Yeah. So that's your rebellious child coming out saying no. So we say in Sandler or in TA, we say don't should on people. Mm-hmm. Don't tell them what they should do or shouldn't do. And especially in sales, don't tell them what they should and shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. If I say, Douglas, you better buy this today because the price goes up on Monday, what's your automatic reaction?
Oh, I'm going to resist it.
Yeah, I'm not going to buy it ever. I don't care how much the price goes up. I'll show you. So like I said, that parent tape, critical parent, nurturing parent, it kind of shuts off around 6-7 years old, but it's there for the rest of your life. It's just in read-only mode. About the same time, that first 5-7 years of life that the parent tape is recording, there's another recorder up there, and that's the child recorder. And it's not recording the messages that are coming in. It's recording the responses that you had. The fears, the anxieties, the happiness, the elation. So if you're happy, if you're sad, glad, mad, or scared, you're in your child ego state. Anytime mm-hmm. experiencing an emotional reaction to something, you're in your child ego state. The child ego state is a very useful part of your life. If you didn't have a child ego state, you would be a person without much fun. I mean, the child adds to your personality as children tend to add to a family. It's just not very useful when you are in sales. Think of being in brain surgery when you're the patient. You don't want your doctor in his child ego state. You want him thinking like a computer. So it's okay certainly to laugh on the outside with your prospect and things like that. But when your child gets the best of you and you become emotionally involved or your natural child wants to make a joke about everything, it's just not a very useful part of your personality as a salesperson. So the third part is the adult ego state. And when you're about 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 months old, you first started making any kind of decision for yourself, processing information from the outside world. That's the logical, I call it the Spock-based, Mr. Spock from Star Trek. Remember that guy?
Yes. Well, he's also, there's been some movies made of it. So I think even the younger listeners are going to know who Mr. Spock is.
And he had no emotional component in his brain. In one episode, he said to Captain Kirk, he said, I'm your most valuable crew member because I am not going to get emotional about things. He was just a computer, a calculator. Mm-hmm. So we want that on the inside of that salesperson to be thinking, acting like an adult. The observer, reading the prospect, thinking, was that what that person just said to me? Is there any basis in truth there? Things like that.
Yeah, so you want to visualize Spock, and you want to engage the prospect's child, but explain why, and you Sandler guys say this all the time, it must be because David Sandler said it, you should always, when you're selling, you need to leave your child in the car.
Yeah, leave the child at home. Don't take your child into your sales calls with you. And so what that means is when I go into a sales call, my mortgage might be dependent on this sale. My car payment might be dependent on it. And I need this money. And if my child comes out and I get emotionally involved and I let on that I want this, I need this, if I stop doing the things that I need to do to make this happen. Here's an example of a child getting involved. Is a salesperson has what they think is a great sales call. Prospect says, hey, this looks really good. I think you're going to make a big sale. Come back next week with a proposal and we'll see what we can do. So that salesperson is excited. By the way, I went through this many times myself as the excited salesperson. And I, run into the sales manager and they say, boss, got a good one. This is looking really good. I think this is going to be a huge sale for me next week. And the experienced sales manager, the experienced boss knows deep down, you got nothing. And it took me several times of getting excited, realizing a week later, nothing was going to happen. It was all for naught. To understand that I needed to stop getting so excited and emotionally involved in this process and stay a little more emotionally objective. My job was nothing more than to get to the truth. Mm-hmm. And if the truth was, Mr. Prospect, you really need and want what I have, let's figure out how we can make that happen. So in fact, that's one of the concepts in the book is, you know, taking the head trash out. And one of the biggest types of head trash that people have is getting emotionally involved in the sales call. So when we say leave the child out, what we mean is don't get emotional. If your child, here's another example. One of the things that causes a lot of salespeople anxiety and did me many years ago is making lots of cold calls.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized it was difficult to dial the number and anxiety producing. And I finally had to talk with myself. And I said, this is that emotional part of your being that's getting involved. And so I literally said, all right, put the child on a stool outside the office door. You stay out there. No, you're not going to get hurt if somebody hangs up on you. You're not going to get hurt if somebody yells at you. You don't have to be responsible. This is just going to be my adult in here in the office making the calls. And my nurturing parent, that'll be the voice on the phone. And when I, and so no matter what happened, people hang up, people say, no, thanks, I'm not interested. In fact, I remember once a guy said to me, this is probably where I did let a little bit of my natural child in, but I remember making a cold call. And after I went through my 30-second commercial, this business owner said, I don't have the time, the interest, or the money for any of what you're talking about. And so I couldn't help myself. I should have. And I said to him, other than those minor objections, is there any reason that you wouldn't want to talk to me? And then he hung up.
Oh, well, you know, you're not making progress unless people are hanging up on you, Brad.
But what ego state do you think jumped in there with me?
The child.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a
child snuck in.
Yeah, let me get back at this guy.
Yeah. You know, as it relates to prospecting, there was one thing I just wanted to mention in the book where you said, flying is to my life as prospecting is to my sales, a necessary but unpleasant duty. And you go on to explain this analogy, which I found helpful. And you said that, you know, when you're prospecting, you don't have to turn suspects into prospects any more than a gold miner has to turn gravel into gold. You're just on a search for that which is already gold, that interested person, so you can set an appointment. So, you know, even though I may have heard this and I read all these books, it was very helpful. Let's talk, speaking of kids, let's talk about the psychological games that buyers play.
Yeah.
Can you explain the Cartman drama triangle?
Yeah, sure. The Cartman drama triangle is just a sort of visual metaphor or illustration for the psychological game. And the idea in a game is that people are not always straight in their transactions, meaning their communications. And a lot of times people want something, but they don't want to ask for it in a straight up manner for lots of reasons. So they resort to psychological games. And it only takes two people to play a game, but there are three positions. The positions are victim, rescuer, and persecutor. And people usually play games to get some kind of need met without doing it, let's say, legitimately. So a person might start out as a victim, and they're looking for maybe a rescuer to rescue them. Here's an example of a game, not exactly in a sales context, but I think it illustrates the concept of the game. And then we can talk about how people play these games when they're prospects in order to get salespeople to cut the price or things like that. So a classic example, by the way, when you think about the parent-adult child, the victim is typically played by the child ego state. The rescuer is typically played by the nurturing parent. And the persecutor is typically played by the critical parent. And I found that most of us, most human beings, have a proclivity to play one of these characters more than the other. And overwhelmingly, I found that most of us tend to be rescuers. But some people do tend to be persecutors or victims. So a good example, real life example of a game was several years ago in my Santa training center on a Monday morning when I was in the room alone getting ready for the people to come in for training, and a trainee who frequently showed up on Monday morning at the first one in there We'll call him Fred to protect the innocent. Fred comes in and he says to me as I'm setting up, he says, "I'm so cold." And it was a very cold day in February. And I said, "Fred, why are you cold?" And all of a sudden I'm thinking, what's going on here? I'm the guy that teaches this stuff, and I didn't realize Fred was getting ready to engage me in a game. So I said, "Why are you so cold?" And he said, "The heater in my car is broken." So Fred's taken the position of victim on, you know, one corner of the Cartman triangle. Me, Mr. Rescuer, I jump in and I say, "Why don't you get it fixed?" I say rescuer because what rescuers do in the game is they apply weak solutions to problems that people should probably fix on their own. So I said, "Why don't you get it fixed?" And this, now there's several types of games. This is called the yes, but game. And what happens is Fred replies hypothetically with yes, but. So he says, "Yeah, that's easy enough for you to say. But remember, I don't have a lot of money. I got five kids. And so I can't get it fixed. I don't have enough money." So if you picture this triangle, these two corners, persecutor and the head hasn't entered yet. The victim, he's playing, and I'm the rescuer. So we're bouncing back and forth. And I said, "Well, you could probably find a mechanic somewhere in town that would repair it for not a lot of money." Second attempt to rescue him. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Yeah, it's easy for you to say, but any amount of money is a lot of money to me." And so I say, "Well, let me ask you a question. What kind of car do you drive?" And he said, "I drive a Cadillac." And I said, "A Cadillac? Why don't you sell the Cadillac and buy a cheaper car that has a heater that works?" Third attempt to rescue. And he says, "I love my Cadillac too much. Couldn't possibly do that." And I said, "Well, I kind of run out of ideas. Like, I don't know what to tell you." And this, now what happens is the switch. And the switch means in the game that the initiator switches positions. And he switched from victim to persecutor. And he said, "Well, I guess you can just stay warm in your car and I'll stay cold in mine." So the game kind of ended there. And I was thinking to myself, my gosh, 4 minutes ago I was setting up for class. And now I feel guilty. I feel bad that Fred has a car with a heater that doesn't work. What happened? And then it hit me. Oh, he played a game. So let me quiz you a little bit.
You took the bait.
I took the bait. No, and that's the thing. There's bait in the middle of that triangle, and the initiator of the game is trying to get somebody else to jump in for the bait. But let me ask you, Douglas, what do you think was the payoff for him of playing this little game with me?
He liked being a victim?
Well, he did. He kind of liked it. And he gets to justify, at least to himself, his lack of responsibility for his own situation. He gets to justify a lack of accountability. And for a moment in time, he gets to feel more okay than somebody else by putting them down in this game. Anyway, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I got sucked into the game. And you know what happened? A week later, he came in and it was the same scenario. I was ready this time. And I remembered, who doesn't play games? Adults don't play games. They just ask questions. So it was uncanny how it started the same way. And he said, "I'm so cold." And I said, "Fred, why are you cold?" And he said, "Don't you remember the heater in my car doesn't work?" So I engaged my adult and I said, "What do you plan on doing about that?" And he said, "I guess I'll have to stay cold." And I said, "Okay, let's get on with class."
Yes, and that's a great contrast, a great example of what you say in the book, which is the best thing to do when a customer starts playing games is to call the game. So at that point, you called the game. You knew it. You knew you were going to get taken in. Let's move on to another topic, and this is going to be of enormous benefit to marketers. Particularly those creating content. And you talk about eliminating your prospects' fears. What are some of the primary fears that resurface in most sales and how best to deal with them?
I think one of the reasons I wrote this was because I remembered way before my sales career started in my Navy time that I had a little shore duty, and one of my best friends, lifelong friends, ever since plebe year at the Naval Academy, good buddies, but, you know, modestly competitive with each other on things. And
is he the one that became the 3-star admiral?
Yes, you know him. I didn't want to implicate him on this broadcast. But anyway, he's a wonderful man. But, you know, when you know a guy for 45 years, once in a while, you'll have a little run in. And so I had just bought a car. And he and I would always talk about buying cars and how to save money on buying cars. And of course, he immediately said, how much did you pay for it? And I said, well, here's how much I paid. He said, how'd you arrive at that? And I told him, I said, well, I found out the invoice price and I added this much and I made the offer and the guy accepted it. And he started laughing at me. He said, you fool, you got ripped off. And I was embarrassed, upset, everything.
Yeah. Nobody wants to be taken advantage of or feel like that.
Right. And it took me a long time to realize, you know, I was very satisfied with that offer when I made it and the guy accepted it. Why should I be embarrassed about it? But I thought, what is one of the fears that people have about making a purchase? They're afraid that they might be a sucker. They're afraid they might pay too much. They're afraid that their neighbor's going to laugh at them.
Mm-hmm. And that's also one of the reasons why buyers want to put off talking to the salesperson until as late as possible and you know, feel like they're getting all the information they need.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so I realized in my own experience, and of course, my wife and I, you know, we buy things. We have a house. We have contractors coming, things like that. And what is one of the discussions always? Oh, are we paying too much? Could we get it less somewhere else? That's a fear that people have. So I think salespeople would be wise to spend some time, not the whole sales call, but some time, exploring that with people. Help me understand. When you talk to somebody in my profession, you probably have a few concerns. I know I started out, Douglas, in the insurance and investment industry when I got out of the Navy before I started my training business. And it took me a little while to realize, but with the help of my coach, who I mentioned in the book, I realized that when people are thinking about buying life insurance, they have a lot of fears. And one of the fears was evident to me was this. Life insurance salespeople are just trying to make a sale. They're trying to make a commission. They're probably going to sell me more than I need. So I learned to ask prospects in the process early on. And I would go something like this. If you were my prospect, I would say, Douglas, I find that a lot of people, when they're contemplating the need for life insurance, have a great fear of taking a recommendation from a life insurance salesperson because they're afraid the recommendation is based on that person's commission. Can you and I talk about that for a second?
Oh, brilliant. And what a great way to invite their kid in, their child.
Right. Because they're and they say, sure, let's talk about it. Well, tell me what your fears are. Now I'm getting their child to tell me their fears and maybe I can help them get over those. Maybe I can't. But either way, I need to know that before I proceed.
Yes, and I just think the more that marketers and salespeople can think about, honestly, what their customers' fears are, and they have them, and who can address them first and foremost, rather than talking about their products and showing that brochure to Brad, are just going to be amazed at how much more effective that approach can be. And again, for all the listeners, you don't have to do all of this perfectly. You just have to do it a little bit better than the competition. And I have a pretty good feeling that if you do just a little bit of it, you're going to be amazed at how it stands out. So let's talk about something that every listener to this podcast aspires to, which is programming their brain for success. Remind listeners why even an average book is better brain food than a great TV show.
Well, for that, you might want to take a look at the chapter 28 on page 115, which is titled, in case you don't remember, TV.
Yes. I, in fact, developed the question from that chapter.
Very good. Well, I think the question is, you know, who's programming my brain for success? And I'm not saying I never watch TV, for sure. But what I am saying is,
well, I mean, how many Naval Academy football games are there on, I mean, throughout the season? But
that I don't attend in person? Not too many.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so true. I on that page, it said you talked about, no doubt there's plenty about which to worry, and the TV has it all. War, economy, politics, bad news, sad news, get mad news. And there's so much of that. They want you. It's the same thing as a casino, trying to get people addicted to, you know, the thrill of winning. All the television, they're trying to get you addicted to staying tuned in order to watch the TV show. And I just talked to so many people who are not conscious. It's like they're not conscious about what they're eating. And as a result, they put a lot of bad things into their body. I think what they're programming their brain with is even more harmful.
It is. It was intriguing to me when I sort of made the connection many years ago that people will fret over the smallest speck of anything on their food. Say when the restaurant brings you a plate of food and you see this little speck of something, you're not going to put that in your mouth. But they had no compelling need to filter the stuff that comes into our ears and our eyes from the radio and TV. And I started thinking, this speck on my food will probably pass through my body, no problem, not cause me a lot of trouble. But all those negative messages on the radio and TV, they're going to be stuck in my brain for a long time. Once again, I'm not saying to not be informed. I'm just saying to be more selective and to program our own brains for success. I think I can program my brain a little better than all the TV commentators. So that's where that whole thing came from.
Well, that really resonated with me, and I felt like, you know, I'm not doing all these things right, but I am trying to read some of these books, and it makes a big difference. So the last thing I want to ask from the book, and we didn't have time for everything, but was something that I heard you say in class years ago, and it really, like many things, I hate to admit it, really resonated with me, and I remembered, Brad. I know you probably don't think I took much from your class, but it was these three rules for life. You say, the three rules for sales and life. So I absorbed that in a class one day, and then as I've gone through life ever since then, I thought, wow, that Brad, he may have been onto something. So can you please tell us your three rules for sales and life?
Well, the ones that are in here, which I aspire to live up to, but will not claim that I'm perfect at it, still a work in progress, probably like some of your listeners. Number one, take responsibility. Take responsibility for your success, your failures. Don't ever blame your prospect when something goes wrong. And the main reason I say that is...
Don't blame the economy.
Yeah.
Don't blame your product. Yeah.
Those are things you cannot fix. You can't fix the economy. You can't fix other people. I'm a believer that the only thing in the world that I can fix is myself. And even attempting to fix myself might not be a perfect effort. So by taking responsibility, I look at the things I can do differently in life. I have a chance of fixing the one thing that's going to make my situation better, as opposed to saying bad leads, bad prospects, prices are too high, bad economy.
Yeah, don't sit in the victim corner of the Cartman drama triangle.
That's right. You're quite a learner too there, Douglas. The second rule.
Thanks, Brad.
Do what you said you would do. And it occurred to me years ago with the proliferation of voicemail. You know what most people's voicemail greeting says? It says,
leave back right away.
I'll call you back right away. And I think three-fourths of these people never call back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm the only person they don't call back. And I thought, sometimes I want to leave a message on their phone that says, would you please change your voicemail greeting to, I'll call you back if it suits me, because that would be more honest. So just do what you said you would do, even if the only person you told was yourself.
Yes, and I am so cognizant of when somebody, particularly in the business world, says they're going to do something and then they don't do it. Particularly if it's something small and insignificant, but they said they were going to do it. And I would, my thought is always, don't tell people what you're going to do. But if you do, you damn well better do it.
And it goes to two big issues, credibility and reliability.
Yeah.
You know, credibility is, can I believe what you're telling me? And reliability is, do you have a history of doing the things that you said you were going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. So the third rule, inspect what you expect. And this is one of those things that I learned in the Navy and when I was a young officer, and some people would go wrong and my captain would say, well, did you inspect it ahead of time? No. Well, guess what? You should inspect what you expect. And it was always kind of got under my skin. But of course, it was one of those things, like something your mother or father told you that ultimately you knew was true. And so if you're expecting something to happen, it might make sense to expect it ahead of time. If you're constantly wondering, why do people not show up for appointments and not call me? Well, maybe you ought to inspect your own process for booking appointments and ask yourself, how do I post-sell these appointments? What kind of questions do I ask people to make sure they're really going to show up? Don't just expect things to happen. Yes. Inspect. So those are the three rules there.
And I like them. And there are no bad prospects, right?
There are no bad prospects. There are only bad salespeople. That kind of goes to take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what the rule for sales managers is, Douglas?
There
are no bad salespeople, only bad sales managers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know what the rule for business owners is? There are no bad sales managers, only bad business owners. In other words, the point is, always look first at yourself. Always look in the mirror first and say, okay, what's my role here? Maybe I do need a new salesperson. Maybe I do need a new sales manager. But before I jump and blame that person, what have I done to take accountability for this situation?
Amen. So, Brad, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I hope it would be fundamentally that sales is no place to get your emotional needs met. And it's a great career, a great profession. It's a great way to make money. It's a great way to give you a lot of freedom and control of your life to have the income you want. But it's not a good place to get your emotional needs met. I always say we want to have good relationships with our clients. And I truly do. And I think you and I are an example of that. But I don't start in the sales world with the idea of this is where I'm going to make my friends. I didn't go into it for that reason. I went into it to make a living. So if friends are a byproduct, that's great. But when I realize I'm here to make a living, it helps me realize, okay, this is not the place to get my emotional needs met. That's something I do in the clubs I'm in and with my neighbors and with my wife and my children and my grandchildren and church and things like that. Those are good places to get emotional needs met, not sales. So that's, to me, the fundamental message of the book, Douglas.
Well said. And you know what else? It reminds me, you shouldn't be getting your emotional needs met in sales or at work. You do need to pursue things in life where you can get your emotional needs met, just like you described. So there may be
woodworking.
Yeah, like woodworking. And I should say, I know where you're going with this. So in our office, we have all these, the company is called Artillery, salesartillery.com. And I went down to Fort Bragg at one point with my son, and I bought all these wooden artillery ammo boxes. And I brought them back. And then Brad McDonald, the great woodworker, he then turned them into furniture and covers for the air conditioning units. And it looks like a World War I bunker now. And then another Naval Academy friend, class of 87, Charlie Daniels, that's his real name, Charlie Daniels. He's quite the woodworker. So he made a few things for me. So I'm just so glad that my tax dollars are going to teach Naval Academy midshipmen woodworking skills. So, and I won't let you respond to that because I know what you'll say, but Brad,
I'll just say this: you're a great supervisor in the wood shop.
Yes. Well, I was an Army officer, so I learned how to supervise. Brad, what books have inspired your working career?
The number one book to me, and I still have my clients now are mostly Sandler franchisees, mm-hmm. and occasionally I have an interaction with a former client. But the number one book that I suggest people read is Born to Win, and Born to Win is, as things go these days, fairly old. I mean, it was published in the early 1960s. The authors were Muriel James and Dorothy Jongward. And it is the quintessential, preeminent, whatever kind of hyperbolic title you can give to it. It is the great book on transactional analysis. And the theme of Born to Win, which I use ultimately to help myself come out of my emotional roller coaster in sales, and I use it when I'm coaching leaders in leadership and salespeople. The theme is how to grow your adult as the executive of your own personality and how to use your adult ego state to filter all of your parent and child reactions to things in life. Does not mean that you turn into a robot. You can be a whole person with all.
You won't. You won't turn into a robot. But if you can get more in that direction or aspire to it, like you talked about, you're going to win more.
Yeah. The second book I would recommend is Change or Die by Alan Deutschman. And Change or Die is, when I first read this book, I thought, oh my gosh, this guy's like a Sandler guy. Of course, that's not where he was coming from. But it was his idea was that if you have 10 people who have a horrible life-threatening condition, whatever that might be, if you don't stop smoking, you're going to die. If you don't change the way you're eating, you might die. If you don't stop this criminal behavior, you might die. He said only 1 out of 10 people, even though all 10 would say, yes, I'll change, only 1 out of 10 would find their way to permanent lasting change. And so he talked about what does it take to change behavior? And of course, that was my process coming out of the Navy. I had to change my behaviors in order to do the things I needed to do in sales. And so Change or Die is, you know, he talks about the three R's: relate, repeat, reframe. And so that's my second one. The third book is Trusted Advisor by David H. Maister.
Oh, yes. I can remember you reading excerpts from that in class.
Yeah. And a few minutes ago, I mentioned credibility and reliability. And he has a trust equation, which says trustworthiness, you know, how much people trust you. It's actually an equation. I love equations, being a math and nuclear engineering guy. And the equation is it's a fraction. And on top of the fraction is your credibility score plus your reliability score plus your intimacy score. And the bottom of the equation or of the fraction is your self-orientation.
S-O, as we used to see it on the board.
Right, yeah, very good. And so the more self-oriented you come across in a sales call, the less you're going to be trusted. So that's a great book. So Born to Win, Change or Die, and Trusted Advisor, three of my favorites.
Wow, that sounds like three great books. I haven't read any of them, and now I probably am. And well, I just want
good. You might have a hard time interviewing the authors of Born to Win because they wrote that in the early 60s, but the other ones maybe so.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting then when an author like yourself recommends a book from years and years ago. Or like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, or any of the other Think and Grow Rich, you know, from 75, maybe up to 100 years ago, they're still so popular. You know, it's after all that time, it was a perennial seller, as Ryan Holiday would say. But I want to mention one thing. You said, I'm no psychologist, for sure. But if I were starting in sales today, I would first run to the nearest bookstore for books on psychology and concern myself with sales tactics later. And those sound like three terrific books. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Well, a little self-promotion in a sense, meaning the company that I'm with, Sandler Systems, the owner who you mentioned, Dave Mattson, he has a new book out, Success Cadence. Find that book at Sandler.com. And Success Cadence is, I think, you know, most of us in the business world, we're looking for some type of success, different definitions of what success is. But he talks about a rhythm, a routine, and a cadence that you can use to achieve success in your business life and your sales life. So I would certainly suggest Success Cadence by David Mattson.
Oh, good, good. Well, I may have to read that one. They're at the end of the book, you listed maybe 25 of the last Sandler books. I think there's even more, and they're, you know, I've enjoyed reading them. They're very well edited. So how best can listeners learn more about you and the book?
Well, of course, you can get the book at shop.sandler.com. Like many people, I'm on LinkedIn, Brad McDonald, and I live in Williamsburg, Virginia, so you might find Brad McDonald somewhere in Virginia. And even though I used to own my own Sandler business in Norfolk, Virginia, I now work for the staff up in Owings Mills. That's where the Sandler Systems franchisor is located. Of course, the bulk of our business is the 250 franchises around the world.
Yeah, and people can also buy your book on Amazon, right?
They can. That's right. They can.
Okay. Well, terrific. We'll include links to everything you've mentioned, your site, the LinkedIn profile. Brad's even on Twitter, and we're going to link to all the books that have been mentioned so people can find those and check them out and decide if they want to get them. We're going to list all that on this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com so that people can find that information. And I hope they'll reach out to you and connect with you and thank you for being a guest. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Art and Skill of Sales Psychology, Why Buyers and Sellers Do What They Do. The author is Brad McDonald. Brad, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that closes the book on episode 233 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/MarketingBookPodcast or just click on the link at MarketingBookPodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Philip Stutz to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Fire Them Now, The 7 Lies Digital Marketers Sell and the Truth About Political Strategies That Help Businesses Win. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by United States Navy veteran Amanda Harrison. Can send you a little thank you in the mail.
Oh, sure. And if you come over this evening, you'll see Luke and Rose and Ewing and Richard Lee.
Oh, wow.
They're going to be here in a little while, so this day is just going to keep getting better.
Wow. Oh, I kind of thought this might be the highlight of the day for you. But that's, you know, I face rejection every day, Brad. And I'm
yeah, I got a book for you. It'll help you through all this.